John Scursi, partner and portfolio manager, founder of Corona Associates. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Chris. It is a pleasure to be back.
I don't know that we've ever had a guest return so quickly. You were gracious enough to re-record this episode as we had a studio glitch. We lost the entire previous nearly 45-minute recording just as it was wrapping up. So let's jump right into crypto space. I mean, you're obviously watching it closely. You have one eye, wary eye, on an even skeptical eye on the Bitcoin phenomenon. This is really the topic du jour. Tell us more, please.
You know, I think that it is something that is here to stay. And I believe that people need to look at it in terms of the fact that it has two components. You know, one is, what is this particular coin or asset worth as a store of value, for example? And what is the concept of it all about in terms of the blockchain capability? And I think what I am intrigued about this whole thing and convinced about is that that particular software platform known as blockchain is truly innovative and truly something that has an important role to play out and is likely to be here to stay. And the question I have in my own mind, which is still unresolved, is how much do you pay for that? And how will this evolve in the sense that just because you are first in this space and you have pioneered, you know, the concept, is the concept going to morph from where it is now, or is it going to, you know, just continue to gain traction? And there are certain things about Bitcoin that I do not like, which is primarily the ownership characteristic. And by that I mean there are a few Bitcoin holders that own the lion's share of the value of all Bitcoin. And I believe if one article that I read recently is accurate, it stated that 4% of the Bitcoin holders actually control or own 90% of the Bitcoin value or market cap. That would mean that there are a small group of people that are literally Bitcoin billionaires. To my way of thinking, they are unlikely to be people that are still buying it. They might be mining it, but I doubt that they're still buying it. They are very likely to be selling it. And if they're selling it, they outnumber or can outnumber the people that are coming in. And the people that are coming in, Coinbase, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, exchange for these cryptos, had actually registered something like, if I'm correct in my memory, 100,000 new users. So that's a lot of new people, probably bringing in a lot of money. And where is the Bitcoin coming from? And we know that mining these new things is very difficult and very energy intensive. It is likely coming from people that already own it. And there are a few people that own a lot of these things. I am wondering myself, in terms of the ownership base, if that is not a very unstable ownership structure where you have a few people who own a lot at a very low cost basis and a whole bunch of brand new people that I think are drawn not so much by their great understanding of what this is. I'm sure there are some people that have a much greater understanding of what it is compared to me, for example. But there are probably people that are coming in just because they see a rising price and they can't stand it anymore. They don't need to know anything more than that. That's one of the things that I've learned as an investor, Chris, is that nothing drives the demand for something more than a rising price. So that will be a very seductive thing to certain kinds of people. And we saw that phenomenon, you know, during the dot-com era, and we may be seeing the same phenomenon with Bitcoin, you know, right now. But having said that, I do think that the blockchain innovation is something that is here to stay. I wonder myself whether or not it can be morphed into blockchain cryptocurrency that is denominated in a fiat currency like the dollar in terms of a government-sponsored crypto, where cryptocurrency doesn't have to change in price day-to-day from supply and demand because, you know, the thing is actually denominated, you know, in a currency that you and I already have in our wallets. That may be, you know, something to consider. And how much does the government want to get involved? Another intriguing thing I read not too long ago, and if I'm remembering it correctly, it was an article that basically said that I believe in the 2015 tax year, the IRS had indicated something like only 44 people had included a Bitcoin transaction on their tax return. You can be sure that the IRS is going to look at this, and whether they can look at it, whether they're just going to go on trust or something, it's a pretty difficult thing for, you know, governments to keep an eye on. It's not possible, but it is certainly a very difficult thing to do. And what will their response be? And maybe their response is a non-response, that they can't do anything.
First, let's address the idea of denominating cryptocurrencies in a fiat money. Well, that defeats the entire purpose of the crypto money. You see, there's a 21 million, as you know, supply of Bitcoin. They'll be fully mined by roughly 2040. And within that time, of course, there's a limited supply, whereas the U.S. dollar has been, as you know, I'm sure, and our listeners know, inflated away roughly 98% from around 1913, worth about 2 pennies. Whereas Bitcoin, because it is, of course, unregulated for the most part, difficult to regulate, similar to email, as we discussed before the show, it had amazing number of non-believers and skeptics. And today, very few people are not texting or sending emails, even our officials, one near the top of the food chain, you might even say. What may be, in the near term, the most important point that folks can take away from this discussion, and that is the parabolic nature of the recent move. We believe that is a direct result of the SegWit or segregated witness, where they're increasing the block size by twofold, and of course the fork amounts to a splitting of the blockchain into SegWit 2 and the original legacy Bitcoin. Of course, this amounts to essentially a 20 to 30% dividend, carrying such a large that will be paid out roughly November 15th or 16th, depending on the blockchain state at that time. You, of course, are carrying an incredible amount of value, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy in a bullish trajectory. Can't help but agree with you. This market is rife for a minimum 40, 50% decline. But if I were to guess, we'll see a 30 to 50% decline in the next few weeks to months.
You know, I just think that it is worthy of people to spend the time to understand what it is and come up with their own conclusions. You know, the parabolic nature of it, you know, I think underscores the fact that there are human beings that are driving this market, and so they are going to be subject to the reactions of human beings and the emotions of human beings. If there really is something of value here long term in terms of adoption and longevity and so on, it's worthwhile learning about this, forming an opinion on it. You may decide that it's, you know, good or bad, or something you want to get involved with or not get involved with, but because of that parabolic rise, don't be surprised if it has some kind of major reaction. And like you point out, it could be 40 or 50% or even more, which might create an opportunity. And, you know, and then it proceeds from there. When you have a situation where a lot of people are coming in, you know, you have to ask yourself, how will they react? Some of those people came in just because it seems to be rising every day. How are they going to react at the first sign of some kind of price decline? And that's also, you know, the problem I have with the equity market. You know, I've never known in my career an equity market that went up every day. You know, good news, bad news, it goes up every day. And I have to question, who are people that are buying this? And what's their risk profile like? And how tested are they when they witness a market decline? Are they going to buy more? Do they have the intellectual and emotional courage to sit with what they did in terms of having bought the top? Or are they going to feel compelled to sell? And if they are going to sell, who are they going to sell to? And at what price are they going to sell? So, you know, we have all the characteristics of a very unstable ownership structure in a lot of these markets, whether it's Bitcoin or whether it's the equity market. And so, you know, to get back to what I had intimated before, we're in a crash-prone environment for many assets.
We talked earlier about how Bitcoin, storage for Bitcoin in Switzerland, a vault there, of course, they hide it under the gold vault. You brought up some interesting parallels between Bitcoin and gold. With the price of Bitcoin now approaching, let's just say sixfold the price of gold, if you were an early adopter, an early entrant, a believer early on, and you have, let's say, 10x'd on your Bitcoin, what a remarkable opportunity you may have to lock in a portion of those profits at least and procure yellow metal at a relative valuation discount.
You know, I couldn't agree more, but you're speaking to somebody who's been a believer of that concept for a long time and has not been rewarded for that particular belief. I consider gold, when it is compared to many of these other things, to be the unbubble, and the reason is that it is so unloved, it is so under-owned, it is so underpriced. I read an article recently which had done some interesting math, which was essentially that if you adjusted the 1980 high on the price of gold for the real rate of inflation since 1980, today it would be priced at over 15,000. That may seem remarkable because you and I know what the price we've seen going across the screen has been recently, but it shouldn't be that remarkable when you consider that the Dow, for example, is up at least the same multiple as its level from 1980. I believe that number is approximately 25 times. If you took this price of gold times 25, you start to see a number that is higher than that 15,000 number. So I can't think of anything, Chris, that hasn't gone up significantly just from inflation. You know, even a can of pork and beans has gone up a lot more than its 1980 price.
You talk about a $15,000 adjustment from 1980, but, you know, the multiple is around 2.6-fold. So if we were to take gold price since then, let's say it was a peak of 800, and we multiply, it's just in the neighborhood of 2,000, not 15,000. Do you suppose they're using a different inflation multiple? And can you back it up? Can you give us any idea what they're looking at?
I do not know what that inflation multiple is. It is obviously different from the official rate, but I believe that it is a well-known fact that since 1980, we have changed the way that the inflation rate is computed. You know, that whole area of statistics known as hedonics, you know, in terms of what the government has done with these statistics, they have been heavily massaged and altered in the time frame to suit, you know, the narrative of the government that wants you to believe that, you know, things like employment or inflation are really not that bad. But if you believe the work in someone like John Williams, who has a very clear-thinking website called shadowstats.com, where he, as an economist, deconstructs the official government data using the methodology of computing that data along the lines of what it was in 1980, he comes up with very different numbers for things like inflation and unemployment. And I know for a fact that he considers the present rate of inflation something closer to 9 or 10% than it is to the official 2% number that we've been hearing about ad nauseum. So I think the difference is how you look at what is the real inflation rate. And I don't know if it's as high as he says it is. I respect his work. But I also know that it is not, as an individual who buys things, I know it is not as low as what the government says it is. So either way, I think that you come away with the notion, the credible notion, that the price of gold that we see today is very understated in relation to what has happened to our money and the value of our money through inflation since 1980. So in terms of making that trade that you described, I would endorse that wholeheartedly. The other reason that, you know, I think, and it's important for people to appreciate this point, which is the other reason to own gold, besides the fact that it's under-owned, it's cheap, and it's undervalued, is the fact that it happens to be the reserve asset that is owned by central banks. And at the end of the day, it's not so much, you know, what you and I think, it's what they think that matters, because they are the ones in the driver's seat when it comes to formulating monetary policy and devising our monetary future, either, you know, correctly or incorrectly. They're the ones that, you know, it's not a democratic institution. They're the ones that decide that outcome. And as long as they are owning gold, there is a very real possibility that they deal with their very real debt problem by changing the value of the asset that they happen to be very long, which is physical gold. And if history is any guide, periods of monetary change or reset or whatever you want to use as the term has been accompanied by changes in the price or value of gold in relation to fiat money in which the debt is denominated. And one of the things that I always come back to when having, you know, the debates about whether things are good or bad, money is worth this or that, I always come back to one thing, Chris, which is, number one, our money, which we use every day, is debt-based money. Number two, there is a lot of debt in the world. There is a lot more debt since 2008, almost, depending on how you look at it, somewhere between 50% more debt and 100% more debt. The debt problem that we had in 2008 did not go away. It got bigger, Chris. And I am still waiting for one person to show me on one piece of paper using math that I can understand, let alone the kind of math that a, you know, Bitcoin code developer can understand, but the kind of math I can understand. Please show me how this debt, one way it can be paid, and I would say the only way it can be paid, is by devaluing the money in which that debt is denominated. You know, one of the parts of the story in Bitcoin is the fact that people are looking for an alternative type of money, an alternative store of value. You know, whether they have correctly turned to Bitcoin as the alternative, that will be demonstrated in the, but gold does have a test of time that you need to look at and respect, because very few, if any, other assets can hold a record like physical gold can in that regard in terms of, time. And it gets back to that other point, you know, whether all of us need to look at it simply because the central banks own it. That's what they use as their store of value. They don't use silver. They don't use Bitcoin. They may in the future, but right now they use gold. And so that's the reason why, as an investor, you need to know what gold is, you need to know what gold does, and why it is what it is. It could be something that could be the solution to our debt problem. And if that's the case, you know, it has a long way to go.
Gold is the hallmark. It's sound money. It's real money. It is the core, the base, the foundation of the portfolio. Whereas the Bitcoin phenomenon, which we believe, and I'd like to address that next, has still possibly further to go, should be viewed as either a component of that portfolio, the core base of gold, silver, and shares. Also, it has a very speculative component until it has a reputation and experience and history as real money that, as you say, central banks hold in their vaults. Moving on, I'd like to address your concerns about such a small number of holders, roughly 4%, own the bulk of Bitcoins. And it's ironic that we could turn this equation around. You would likely find less than 1% of the population of the world, probably a fraction of that 1%, owns the bulk of fiat money and related assets on that, let's call it fiat money blockchain, i.e. stocks, bonds, real estate, and precious metal. Secondly, I'd like to note that less than 1% of the world currently have any Bitcoin whatsoever exposure or a wallet. We talked about this earlier, Metcalfe's Law, which shows you simply take the square of the number of users in a network, which, of course, blockchain is de facto a network, and multiply that by the daily transactions. Well, you get an exponential increase in valuation of Bitcoin or of the network with a very small increase in the number of users. And current growth estimates indicate that we could see doubling of the number of users in Bitcoin for many years. When you double that and put it on an exponential chart, it really bodes well, at least hypothetically, for the price of Bitcoin. Can you address these points I've just brought up in the context of your 4% holders of Bitcoin?
You know, I think you raise a very good point. You know, not only do these 4% people own the bulk of these Bitcoins, but their cost basis is probably de minimis in relation to the price that we're seeing. You know, at the end of the day, I think you still have, you know, human beings as your actors in these markets, and there is an important speculative, you know, aspect to anything that has had the kind of trajectory of this. But, you know, you raise a very good point that there are very few people that own the very bulk of financial assets, of fiat currency, and so on. The one difference may be what their respective cost basis may be. If a pension fund, for example, is one of those few holders, their cost is not zero on those that they have. The other aspect is, of course, you know, what is the component to what determines, you know, the asset value of things like financial assets. And they are tied to debt. So if we had an environment where interest rates increase, you're going to see the value of those financial assets go down. Will it bring down the price of Bitcoin? Will it be subject to the same kind of tidal wave of liquidity, either moving in or moving out? My takeaway, you know, to people right now is that everything is in a state of major flux. And we cannot lose sight of the fact that the world as we see it right now, the financial markets as we see them right now, the prices that we see right now, do not ignore the fact or lose track of the fact that we are resting on a tidal wave of 8 years of cumulative liquidity additions to the world that were completely spun out of the machinations of the central banks, rightly or wrongly. This was not a natural phenomenon. And for the very first time in 8 years, we have begun to take steps to withdraw that tsunami of liquidity. So this is a time where all of us need to examine what we are doing, why we are doing it, and what we're paying for these things. you know, we blithely go from day to day thinking that today is going to be a lot like yesterday and a lot like the day before. And sometimes we forget, you know, that all of this was different because of what happened in 2008. We had to apply this enormously huge liquidity intervention, which was born out of a circumstance of emergency because our very global financial system was in a state of sudden death. And certain big players were taken out in a box. Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, same thing. Merrill Lynch, de facto the same thing.
Oh, sure. AIG, the nation's largest insurer, would have evaporated were it not for the bailout. General Motors.
And what has happened last month took a baby step to prove the narrative that everything was okay. Everything was okay.
Read a brilliant article late last night. The West Coast is experiencing, you may have read, a homelessness epidemic. A huge component of this story is that folks have simply been priced out of their homes because of the inflation you've referred to, the asset bubble narrative. Some of the folks who were interviewed in these deplorable tent cities are Hoover shacks, I think they used to call them in the 20s and 30s, but were folks who were working 9-to-5 jobs but couldn't even afford basic living, a basic apartment or a mortgage on the smallest home amid this inflation that we've talked about today. We talked earlier about the St. Louis Fed's M1 number, and you juxtapose that chart with the S&P 500, the correlation is close to 1-to-1, i.e., the Fed and their compadres may just be culpable for this 8-to-9-year bull market in shares. You would prefer to see people locking in at least some of those stocks, bonds, and look for better valuations and undervalued assets, such as the precious metals.
I mean, I consider gold the unbubble asset. You know, it's the one most important asset. You know, there are people that would argue it is the most important asset when it comes to being a store of value because it has a test of time that can demonstrate it can convey value indefinitely into the future. It also does so without being a debt instrument, meaning it does not have a counterparty problem. It does not have a credit issue with it. And there are just so many things, as you point out, you know, that would be inconsistent with the concept that, you know, that we are supposed to accept that everything is okay. You know, as you point out, the, you know, how is it that you can see, you know, this kind of homelessness if things are okay, you know, and so many other things. How can all these retailers be going out of business when the economy is supposedly 70% consumer driven and yet retailers are going out of business? Yes, I understand that Amazon has been a game changer in that space, but it's not the sole explanation. You know, the state of health of the consumer is something, in my opinion, that is less than robust. So, you know, I question this concept that everything is okay. Another thing that I would point out is this everything okay economy comes with a deficit spending package on the part of the United States government, which is virtually unprecedented. And again, we have gotten used to it, that somehow spending, the government spending an extra $1 trillion per annum is okay. Well, here's the question I would ask someone to think about. What would our economy today in the United States look like if the government didn't spend an extra $1 trillion, would everything still be okay?
It's the key question. John Scursi, wealth of knowledge, as usual, for investors. Take a look at your portfolios. What's overvalued? Where is the deficit? If the deficit is gold, silver, related assets, why not lock in, book some profits, position your portfolio for the next bull market? Think about the return of your capital over the return on your capital. John Scursi, more information, please, on Corona Associates Capital Management, LLC. Any contact information?
Anyone that wants to learn about what we are doing, Chris, can go to our website, www.coronacap.com. We've got a lot of info on there, and there are phone numbers for anyone that wants to contact us, you know, find out more about what we do, and we always welcome any and all new inquiries from people.
We just can't thank you enough for your time and being so gracious as to re-record. Not many people have the intestinal fortitude nor the wherewithal to sustain two back-to-back interviews. Again, John Scorsese, thank you so much. Let's hopefully have you back as soon as possible with the latest topicality and all of your insights.
Chris, it has been a real pleasure.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%. totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.